Hey, just before the episode starts, I wanted to issue a quick trigger warning. One of the movies we discuss on this episode deals with some very emotionally heavy topics, including death by suicide. The film takes that subject very seriously and respectfully, and so do we in our discussion of it, but I'd still advise you to only listen to this episode if you feel ready for that. All right, on to the episode. Hello, hello, and welcome back to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and I want to start by saying Happy Pride! It's June, and to celebrate Pride Month, we're dedicating both of the June episodes to queer cinema. We are putting the Technicolor Marathon on hold for a few weeks, but don't fret, Rance Collins is back today to discuss our first Pride Month film, which is called The Children's Hour. Before we get to that, I'll give my quick review of the film that won the Grand Jury Prize at 2020's Venice Film Festival and just hit theaters this year, a Mexican film called New Order. Stick around. In 2019, the film Parasite came out, and besides winning all of the major film awards, it served to highlight income inequality, which is something that has plagued the world's capitalist societies forever. And like the best movies, Parasite looks at the issue through the empathetic lens of cinema. You could read about the wealth gap all day, but it's different to see characters experience poverty and to feel desperate and angry alongside them. Parasite ultimately becomes violent, and the character motivations that get us there feel real and relatable, and that's part of what makes the movie so good. The violent place that Parasite ends is where New Order begins. The new film from Mexican director Michel Franco won the Grand Jury Prize at 2020's Venice Film Festival and just hit cinemas this year, and it tells a story of uprising. It opens on a lavish wedding in the extravagant home of a wealthy Mexican family, and the film lays subtle hints showing the vastly different life experiences of the well-off family members versus their lower-class maids and grounds workers. And all of this happens while news reports play in the background telling about riots happening in the nearby area. Things come to a head in a thrilling and terrifying scene depicting the lower-class mob overtaking the wedding party with brutality and righteous anger. That's where things begin, and from there we follow the bride, Marianne, who has managed to escape the house alive. She tries to navigate the city, which is in a state of serious unrest after rioters have killed untold hundreds, and the military begins to take control and establish a police state. The film is ultimately an intense and largely tragic series of events, and not for the faint of heart. Despite the heaviness of the story, New Order is incredibly stylish. It's full of engrossing verite camera work and really bold colors. Marianne wears this bright red suit for much of the film. It's really striking. And the rioters have this deep green paint of some kind that sort of seems symbolic of their resistance. And they throw it at people and it shows up in unexpected places. There are some truly stunning shots here, including a sequence inside a moving car that reminded me of some of the incredible shots in the film Children of Men from another Mexican director, one of my favorites, Alfonso Cuarón. The subject matter of New Order feels up to the minute in the way it addresses social class and the rising tension that seems to be building in recent years all over the world. And the film makes a strong case that things need to be changed on a macro level before something like this really happens. It really makes this kind of uprising feel real and believable in the way that cinema does best. But as prescient as much of this movie feels, the story loses a lot of steam as it goes on. The film is never as strong as that wedding sequence at the opening third, and it would actually be a stronger piece of cinema if you cut the story off there and just called it a short film. After that spectacular beginning, it feels like a slog to get to the movie's end. Marianne runs into problem after problem, and the story gets so dark in some moments that it borders on, like, misery porn. And for what? A plotline that isn't particularly compelling as human drama, and really only serves to demonstrate how bad things are. The cautionary tale felt like it was complete after the first 30 minutes, and everything else feels like self-serious overkill. But even with those complaints, the technical craft on display in New Order and the sheer size of the story are remarkable. It's no wonder this film impressed festival audiences. There are scenes in this film I will never forget, and many of the film's single images are spectacular. If you're in the mood for something unique and intense, this movie may be right up your alley, but be prepared for a story that's emotionally challenging to the point of feeling oppressive. But if you can stomach all that, director Michelle Franco's sense of style and pacing is nothing if not memorable. New Order is now playing in theaters. June is Pride Month, and as mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to use both June episodes to look at some LGBTQ+ films. But just before we get into that, I'd like to make it clear that Arthouse Garage is a safe and inclusive space. I believe strongly that movies are for everyone, and that emphatically includes people in the LGBTQ+ community. So, to all of our LGBTQ+ listeners, you are welcome and affirmed here. Cinema also has an amazing way of providing a voice for marginalized people, and so I thought, since I'm a podcaster, what better way to be an ally than to create space for discussion around queer themes in cinema, since members of the LGBTQ+ community have historically been so marginalized. And one more thing before we get into the movie discussion. I wanted to say that, like a lot of people in the South, I grew up in spaces that were very much not inclusive or affirming, and it took years for me to truly see the damage being caused to LGBTQ+ people, especially young people, whether that damage comes from family members or the church or the state legislature. And that's actually going to play somewhat into our movie discussion today, but I've put a link in the show notes to a couple of studies done by the Trevor Project. These studies look at the mental health challenges that LGBTQ+ youth face as the Trevor Project seeks to prevent suicide in LGBTQ youth. So please click those links and look through those. I think personal education is a really important step towards a more fully inclusive society. And with that, let us once again welcome classic film guru Rance Collins. I'll remind you all again to check out his podcast on Oscars history called The Envelope, Please. It is excellent. Welcome back again, Rance. How are you?
Oh my gosh, I'm so good. So good to be here. I feel like I may need to get upgraded from being a guest to being like a recurring character, you know,
I like
at,
that.
At
yeah.
this point.
I can
because I feel like I've been on enough to be considered recurring status.
Yes, I agree. I think there's you and maybe only one or two other people that would fit that bill, but I can make you guys t-shirts or something.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Well, when I started planning around Pride Month, I thought, you know, I want to do something, in the queer cinema space. I also want to have people besides myself talking about them. I was like, who do I know that's gay and loves movies? Well, of course, Rance. I did have a few other names, but like Rance is the easiest person to get. Let's have Rance do this. And so I asked you.
Ironically, a lot of other gay guys say Rance is the easiest person to get, but that's a different.
Oh my goodness, that's hilarious. Well,
I'm kidding.
So I asked you to pick the movie that we talk about, and it's a very interesting one. Just before we get to that, though. I wanted to ask you about something that happened in the news recently that I thought you might have an opinion about, and that is the big MGM news. So for listeners who don't know, Amazon purchased MGM for something like $9 billion, and it's kind of a big deal. So I want to see if you have, you know, negative, positive thoughts about that whole situation.
You know, I've been asking a lot of people the same question, actually, because I've been trying to figure out whether or not it's good or bad news too.
Yeah.
the thing with MGM that's like so difficult to gauge is that MGM as a company has struggled so much for the last several decades. I mean, you know, MGM as a power source of film hasn't really existed in our lifetime.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
They have Bond, you know, because of United Artists, but the United Artists library is the biggest part of MGM, I think, more so than the movies that the studio actually produced in the last 30 or 40 years, because the crown jewels of the MGM library are in possession of Warner Brothers.
Yeah, so like that's not even part of this, right?
Yeah, so if you're Wizard of Oz, Singing in the Rain, Gone with the Wind, you know, the movies that people think about as being MGM movies, those don't exist in the movies that make money, if you will, outside of Bond, don't exist in the MGM library. So for a lot of it, you know, MGM is still very much emotionally in our culture, a very big deal, because that lion roaring at the beginning of the movie is there's something cinematic and special about that.
Yeah.
You know, it's Leo the lion. I shouldn't say that lion. I was really disrespectful. So on the one hand, it feels like getting a company that's huge and successful in streaming content, getting possession of MGM probably might be some insurance in a way, for a company that's always on the verge of going away. But also, and I mean, it's not like they don't have a studio lot. They just have offices in a tower in, I think, Century City right now. It's moved around. They were in Santa Monica for a little while. I think it's in Century City now. And it's literally just a couple floors of offices. That's what MGM is now, in a high rise. And that's very sad, because, you know, they used to be this huge mega powerhouse. But, you know, Amazon is now leasing a studio lot in Culver City, which I guess is probably where they're going to move the MGM offices to. So on the one hand, you know, that may get them back on a lot. That said, the lot that they're leasing, which is right across the street from the old MGM studios, which is now Sony, that lot, which used to be, it was RKO way back in the day, one of the two RKO lots, and then also was Desilu for a while, and it's called the Culver Studios now. It has, it's also where Selznick, David O. Selznick, produced most of his movies. They tore down several sound stages and replaced them with big glass office buildings instead. So, you know, they're making it less, it's only partially a studio space now. And they took away these, you know, super old, like 100-year-old sound stages for these big glass office buildings. And if that's what Amazon is thinking of being the movie business, that makes me sad. And that gives me pause.
Yeah.
Because
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to feel about it. I mean, like, it's like, what's the worst thing that could happen to MGM now? Cause it's barely existed to begin with, but also you want to see the rebirth of the lion, because it's so intrinsic to movie.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I have such mixed feelings about, like, you know, anything Amazon does, because there's such huge tech companies controlling the world. This just makes me queasy. But I think, you know, in a perfect world, they're going to put a bunch of movies in their library to make them more accessible. That's a good thing, I think. And then hopefully not devalue stuff that's coming out, because Amazon Studios has had some good movies come out,
I mean, Sick was an Amazon movie, and that movie is great.
I remember Manchester by the Sea was one of the Amazon releases
that I'm
always a little surprised, because it's not like I think about it as an Amazon movie the way I would other studios, maybe, like I don't know, like Mank or something. I'm like, okay, that's a Netflix movie. But then I see that Amazon logo at the beginning. Oh, this is an Amazon thing. But yeah, I guess the worry is that they're going to like devalue Bond or something. But I think that there's not much danger of that anyway, because that's co-owned, right, by the whatever the studio that owns Bond. So
yeah, well, they have, you know, they've had distribution deals through other studios, but the Broccoli family has like co-ownership of Bond, and I am sure that they are, you know, Barbara Broccoli, I believe is her name, who is carrying on that legacy now, and Eon Productions, that's what they're called. And I am, whenever you get to talking about the new Bond movie, you should have me on, because I've watched all of them. I binged all of, mostly during quarantine, I binged all 24 official Bonds and the two not official Bonds. Wow, so wow. I have opinions.
you're versed. Yes.
And one of my opinions is that I am a Roger Moore defender. I think he gets a bad rap. But anyway, I think that it'll be interesting. It's also interesting that this news happened right after we learned that AT&T is divesting themselves.
Yeah, so now Discovery owns HBO, which is so strange to me, but you know, whatever.
Well, I mean, it's an entertainment company, so at least it's, you know, in that family. But the thing that's interesting about that is like one tech company dumped their studio, and another tech company is buying a studio. So we have, you know, it's interesting. You know, tech definitely sees the convergence of the mediums.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder, I've heard, you know, pundits saying, you know, we may see more big companies. Apple could buy, you know, whatever studios that are struggling right now. So yeah, it's interesting. Well, I guess it'll be something to follow. But well, thanks for giving your thoughts. I was like, as soon as it happened, I was like, I gotta ask Rance about this, because he might have some thoughts. Well,
many thoughts. Okay,
let's move on and talk about today's movie, The Children's Hour.
Go back to Joe, Karen. It's too much for you this way.
Stop talking about it, Martha.
Let's pack and get out of here. Let's take the train tomorrow.
The train to where?
I don't know. There must be some place we can go.
I don't know where it is. They know about us. We've been famous.
But this isn't a nuisance, they say. We've done. Other people haven't been destroyed by it.
They're the people who believe in it. Who want it. Who've chosen it for themselves. We aren't like that. That must be very different. We don't love each other. We've been close to each other. Of course, I've loved you like a friend. The way thousands of women feel about other women. You were a dear friend who was loved, that's all. Certainly there can be nothing wrong with that.
This is a movie that I believe is now owned by Amazon.
Oh, wow. So maybe this will be streaming. We were just talking about how this wasn't streaming anywhere convenient, but maybe it will be on Amazon before long. The movie is called The Children's Hour. And it's amazing because, so we're going to talk kind of, we're going to talk spoilers, but not yet. We'll talk kind of our general reactions and some of the history behind it before we get to spoiling it. We do need to talk about the ending of this movie. But yeah, you chose this as something to talk about for Pride Month, and it's something I'd never even heard of. And so I'm so glad I asked you that. These are the kind of things that I discover doing this show, but, and the cast is incredible. And I was like, how have I not heard of this movie? But the basic setup of it, well, just like very, very basic. And then we can talk about kind of, some of the context, but it is about two women who run a, girls' boarding school. And they are Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine. So like, yeah, I was like, how had I never heard of this with these two actors in it? Mm-hmm. And there is an accusation that they have a quote unquote unnatural relationship, which is, there's a lot of coded language, is 1961. So there's very little that's explicitly stated. But just the accusation, has some very detrimental effects on, on their lives. And so it kind of goes into all kinds of things with that. And there's some surprises that happen along the way too. So it's really an interesting movie. Like, so I was watching this, I was like, this is such a fascinating thing. This document from this time period. And like, again, how have I never heard of this? So, yeah. When did you first see it, and kind of what's your feelings around this movie generally?
I first saw it. I don't remember. I may have Netflixed the DVD like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And then I saw it again a few years later, where I see so many things, the TCM Film Festival. Yeah. And, they had Shirley MacLaine there.
Oh, wow.
Do a Q&A. And she, it was really funny. When we talk about the ending later, I'm going to mention a little bit more of this story, but she misremembered the ending.
Details of the film. So,
wow. Yeah, the details of the film. But she did it kind of hilariously, because it was, she gave a major spoiler, but she gave it wrong. So it wasn't like she so everyone gasped after she said it, like, oh, and she was like, oh, and then she said something like, well, you've had 50 years. And then it turned out like she spoiled it incorrectly. So it was fine. I saw it those two times, and then I saw a documentary a few months ago called The Celluloid Closet, which is a wonderful documentary. I highly recommend it. It would actually be something good to discuss on your podcast probably at some point.
I'm going to make a note of that.
I saw that documentary, and they discussed this movie in a larger context with some other films of the period that were starting to address homosexuality in various ways. And it made me even more fascinated with the subject material and what it represents for that time. So anyway, it's an interesting one to discuss for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And it, without spoiling it, I'll just say I was surprised by how heavy it gets, because again, we'll talk about it later, but it really took me off guard in a lot of ways. But it's, so 1961. And so I understand there's actually sort of another version of this, and it's based on a play. Is that all correct?
Yes. There is, it was originally a play, that came out in the 30s, if you'll believe it. Very much like it, like you see it on screen in what we just watched. It existed in the New York theater. Only a couple of details were changed, and, that, you know, barely flew on stage in the 1930s. Yeah. In fact, there were laws against such lewd material, but they made an exception because of how well received it was. And then there was one, Samuel Goldwyn, wanted to adapt the play. It was 1936. There was no way you're going to adapt it the way that it existed. So they changed a few details to where the central lie, the rumor that is the bedrock of the story, was changed to be about a straight affair, not a gay affair.
Interesting.
Then it was directed by William Wyler. And then William Wyler revisited it when the restrictions with the code were more relaxed, and he was able to adapt the play as it was.
Yeah, and that previous version is called These Three. I'm looking at it now, and it is on Prime Video, so you can watch that one on Prime.
One of the female stars of that is Miriam Hopkins, who has a small role in this movie.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah, I was looking. I thought that name sounded familiar. Great. But yeah, so it's a complicated story, but I know you love William Wyler as a director, so when I realized, I was like, oh, this is a William Wyler thing. No wonder Rance likes it. But yeah, it really is good. So I guess let's talk about the actors, because, so first of all, let's talk about William Wyler, I guess, a little bit. We've talked about him before on the podcast, but he has a pretty enormous body of work. We talked about the best years of our lives before, about a year ago or something. And I really, really like that one. What else is he kind of known for?
William Wyler is one of the most prolific directors of that period, but he's also one of the most diverse directors and one of the very few that really had just like a total control of his work. He gained a certain amount of respect and then was able to basically, you know, do the projects as he wanted. But he seemed to have like no limit for types of content, because he did obviously a kind of a melodrama like this, which deals with a very edgy for the time period subject. But he also did a quintessential romantic comedy and Roman Holiday. He did one of the most popular star musicals of all time, Funny Girl. He did the quintessential biblical epic, Ben-Hur. He did The Best Years of Our Lives, which, you know, is a wartime film. Wyler also did a series of really great movies with that won various Performers Academy Awards. He did The Heiress with Olivia de Havilland, which was her second Oscar win. He did Bette Davis and Jezebel, which was her Oscar win. He actually has the most winning performances of any director. He's directed the most people to Oscars.
Wow.
Of any director. And he himself won 3 Academy Awards for Best Director, including, I already mentioned The Best Years of Our Lives and Ben-Hur, but also the wartime drama Mrs. Miniver, which also won Best Picture. So really there's like, he's just one of those people where it's just seemingly there's nothing you can't do. And, it's just a stellar, amazing body of work. And, there's another movie called Dodsworth that is very little known that was made, I believe the same year as these three, 1936, that he did that, would be a good discussion movie one day too. It's just, he's my favorite.
So William Wyler, it's so interesting that, you know, you talk about the total control he gained because of, he was so prolific, and he was operating in a time we didn't really have like auteurs the way we think of them now. So I think it's so interesting that he was able to do that. Well, this film stars Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine. And it's so funny because I mean, I'm very aware of Audrey Hepburn as a performer, but I actually have seen relatively few of her films. So she's so great in this, and so is Shirley MacLaine, both operating like the top of their game as far as I'm concerned, like really, really good. So I mean, do we want to talk about like Audrey Hepburn's, you know,
oh yeah, for deal sure.
If people aren't,
you know,
familiar,
it's interesting
with
her? Audrey Hepburn, I'm sure most people are familiar with. I bet you most people have maybe only seen one, if any, Audrey Hepburn movies though. And that isn't, I mean, like, I'm not going to knock people too much for that, because the fact is she didn't make that many movies. She only, less than 20. I don't remember what the exact number is, but she was pretty choosy with her projects. She was a top box office star from about 1953 with Roman Holiday. Till about 1967, when she made both Wait Until Dark and Two for the Road. And that 14-year period, you know, she's ruling the roost. And then she chooses to concentrate on her family and doesn't really make movies for about a decade. And then after that, only makes a few movies sparingly, with her last theatrical film being the Steven Spielberg film Always, in case anyone's wondering. So she has a career that spans all the way to Spielberg, but there's very she's very choosy, but the movies she makes are all like very wise choices, because there are very few duds in her filmography. You know, very few movies that people couldn't watch and get something from today. She's probably most famous for Breakfast at Tiffany's, In large part because of the style of her in that movie, the little black dress, and you know, just eating a bagel or a donut. Is it a bagel or a donut in front of Tiffany's?
Yeah, bagel. I think
she's despite controversy surrounding this particular film and its casting, she is known for My Fair Lady, probably in popular culture as well. And Sabrina and Roman Holiday. So there's a lot of good movies to choose from, but I think what a lot of people don't realize about her, you know, cause she comes off as this kind of light, airy, you know, often very funny, woman, is they don't know how good she is of a dramatic actress. And this is one of the best examples, alongside another movie called The Nun's Story, I would say, perhaps her best dramatic performance.
Yeah, because in this, she really has some very fiery moments where she, you know, is kind of giving some vitriol to some other characters. And yeah, just it's a little bit not what I expect from Audrey Hepburn, but it was really, really good. Yeah, so fantastic to see her in this. And it definitely gave me, colored my perception of her in a good way, I think. Shirley MacLaine, let's talk about her. So she's been around for so long and done so many things.
Yeah. It's funny. I forget how long her career is sometimes, because I think that I associate her heyday as being in the 80s, you know? Because the thing I think I most associate her with is Terms of Endearment, and Steel Magnolias, things like that. And it's so interesting that she has had a career that has spanned so many phases to the point where she continues to get cast in, you know, grandmother roles now, regularly today. And she's still very much a presence in the world of film. And also, this is just an aside, I always forget that she's Warren Beatty's sister.
Oh yeah, I forget that too. Yeah.
And then, and that just adds a whole other level of interesting to her life, and the fact that in her opinion, she has had many lives. So, you know, she's famous for being a new agey, you know, in her thoughts and beliefs. And, she actually makes a cameo in a movie called Defending Your Life, which is a really great Albert Brooks comedy from the 90s that has Meryl Streep in it as well, and as Albert Brooks. And it's like, it takes place in heaven, but it takes place, excuse me, in purgatory. And
never heard of
people,
this.
It's like in the city that you stay in before you get to go to heaven, or, you know, if you're just going to end up staying in purgatory forever or whatever. And, she has a cameo in this one section as a past life expert,
which is sort of reflecting her real life, like expertise, quote unquote expertise on that. Right.
Yeah.
When I think of Shirley MacLaine, I always think about The Apartment, which is one of my very favorite movies. And I kind of experienced it when I was, you know, learning about feminism for the first time, kind of, and she just breaks your heart, and it kind of helped me have a little more empathy for, I don't know, the female experience in a way that I didn't have before. And she's so good in that. So that will forever be one of my favorite Shirley MacLaine things is The Apartment.
She has that great line. She has that great line in the Apartment about the broken mirror. Some of my favorite pieces of dialogue, you know, the, why is your mirror broken? Because it makes me look the way I feel, or whatever the line is.
Yes, that's a very good movie. Well,
it is a great movie.
So anyway, the other actors in the Children's Hour are maybe less. I didn't recognize really any of them by name, at least. But yeah, let's talk about some of them. So James Garner is the male lead here.
Do you know James Garner?
Not that well. His name sounds familiar, but.
James Garner is was a really steady leading man in the 60s. He had been on TV in a TV show called Maverick, which was later made into a movie with Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster and James Garner as well. They had James, they brought him back as a, you know, hat tip to his TV show. And, which hat tip really works well when you're talking about a Western.
Cowboys, yeah.
I didn't even intend to make there that pun. And then he also became a romantic lead in like Doris Day comedies in the 1960s. And then he was on a TV show in the 70s as well. The name is escaping me right now. It was like a procedural
in the 70s, let's see. Nichols, Sheriff Frank Nichols and Nichols, or
The Rock Files.
Oh, The Rock Files. Yeah, yeah, yes.
Yes. And then he was in the 60s, he also was in The Great Escape. He's the other lead besides
I've definitely
Queen.
Seen that. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And he was in a John Frankenheimer movie called Grand Prix. And you know, John Frankenheimer is incredible. And he also was, you know, all the way up to movies like Space Cowboy.
Yeah, I was just seeing that and The Notebook. I think he's the old man in The Notebook, right?
The old man in The Notebook. Oh, that's probably what I should have led with for people.
I went to his IMDb and it's like, oh, The Notebook, there you go.
That and Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood. You know, those are the ones that people probably know. But he's one of those people that you may not know, but you know.
Yes, I'm realizing that live on the air. It's like, oh yeah, I do know this guy.
I mentioned Miriam Hopkins earlier. She was a pretty prolific leading actress, particularly in the 30s. She made a lot of really good pre-codes when she was a younger leading lady. So she did some racier fare. Then there's an actress named Faye Bainter who plays the aunt in the movie. And Faye Bainter,
things up in a way,
yeah, she's the one who basically causes everything to happen. Well, her granddaughter is the one who causes everything to happen, but she puts it in further motion. Was in a William Wyler film that I mentioned earlier called Jezebel, and she won Best Supporting Actress for playing an aunt in that movie in the 30s. And she was the first person to be nominated in both lead and supporting in the same year, because she was also nominated for a leading role in 1938 for a movie. So she had a pretty extended Hollywood history of acting in movies. And then the not the granddaughter, but the granddaughter's friend that she blackmails.
Yes, who is named Rosalie. It's Veronica Cartwright.
It's Veronica Cartwright, who is probably better known for being the younger sister in The Birds.
Okay, yeah. And she's an alien, and I recognize her adult face on IMDb.
She's okay. If you've never seen Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Okay. I have, but it's been such a long time. Yeah.
This is a little bit of a spoiler.
Okay.
But in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, she's the last survivor.
Ah. Okay.
Before, and she, the very famous ending shot of that movie of Donald Sutherland pointing, he is pointing at Veronica Cartwright.
There you go.
And she played in connecting it to Pride, she played Jack McFarlane's mother on Will and Grace. There's an episode where he comes out to her. That's one of the better episodes of that show.
That's very interesting. I'm just noticing too, speaking of Pride, she's in a movie, a really small movie that I saw last year as part of the LGBT Kaleidoscope Festival called Breaking Fast. And she plays someone's mother, I think, in it. And, it's like a pretty small movie. I was like, oh, I know that one. And it's about a Muslim doctor who's gay in LA. There's a whole lot about like Muslim culture. It's really an interesting movie that's called Breaking Fast. And it looks like it's on Hulu. So you can watch that if you want.
Look at that. So yeah, she so there's some this is a pretty deep bench, if you will. You know, it's a good can it's a good kaleidoscope of people.
Yes, there's a kaleidoscope reference again too. Yes, yeah, all over the place, and really, really well written. So I guess let's talk about the plot, and maybe we can talk about the first third or so before we spoil
Oh,
anything.
and
Go ahead, go ahead.
yeah, the writing should mention here. The screenplay was by John Michael Hayes, who was one of Hitchcock's favorite writers.
Oh
He
yeah, I'm
wrote
seeing
Rear
Rear Window.
Window,
Yep.
The Trouble with Harry, which is Shirley MacLaine's film debut, and he wrote The Man Who Knew Too Much. So he has a pretty good resume. And then Lillian Hellman is one of like the preeminent who did the stage play. She's one of the preeminent playwrights of the 20th century. She wrote something called The Little Foxes, which got Bette Davis an Academy Award nomination and was another William Wyler movie. She also wrote a story about her supposed activities during World War II. Lots of debate as to whether or not she was as heroic as her stories say. But her stories were turned into a movie called Julia, which was starred Jane Fonda as Lillian Hellman
Interesting.
in the 1970s. Anyway,
So yeah, she's a big deal too. Yeah.
she was also the romantic partner of Dashiell Hammett.
Oh, okay.
So,
Wow.
yeah. So she has a pretty
Yeah.
interesting life at a ba at the base right there.
Yeah.
But yeah, the writing is pretty astounding in this film.
It really is, and I guess with that we can talk about the movie a little bit. So yeah, it opens with, on this school, and you're kind of learning, the ins and outs. The young girls live there. They're, barely making money. They're making money for the first time, kind of just finally breaking even, and you can tell that these two women do everything. Like they're doing the dishes, they're like washing the laundry, they're the teachers. They're doing the business, like paying the bills and everything. And so like they're kind of spread thin, and that's made a little more complicated because Audrey Hepburn's character, whose name is Karen, is engaged or not engaged, has not committed to be engaged yet to Dr. Joe Carden, who's James Garner. And he's always, saying, "Why won't you marry me?" And she's like, "Well, we got to get the school on its feet before I can do that." So they're kind of right on the cusp of wanting to do that, and she finally says, "Okay, we're doing well enough." And then that news is not something that Martha, played by Shirley MacLaine, takes well, and it's clear early on that she's unhappy with Dr. Joe's presence at all, because he kind of represents, taking her away from the school, and it's not clear how they're gonna be able to keep going if she leaves and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the very initial tension of the movie, and then that one of the girls who is troubled, we shall say, she causes a lot of trouble. Her name's Mary, and essentially the inciting incident that happens about a third into this is she tells a lie that these two women, Karen and Martha, who run the school, are again, there's a lot of coded language. Like they never use the word lesbian in this movie at all, nothing like that. But she says they have an unnatural relationship, and she tells her grandmother this, who her grandmother's the only person she seems to love or trust. And she's fed up because she gets in trouble all the time, and she also blackmails other students, and that plays into it as well. And so yeah, that's the inciting kind of thing that happens pretty early on, and from there's just a lot of tumultuous drama that kind of ratchets up and up. Yeah, have I left anything else out of the beginning of that?
I think that's a you set it up pretty well. Yeah,
I guess maybe from here we should say spoiler alert. There's a
yeah,
little
I
more
don't
we
know
could
how to
talk
talk
about,
about it.
but
I
yeah,
don't know how we can talk about
we
it.
kind of have to talk about the ending of this. So if you've not seen it, go watch it. You can rent it anywhere. It is again, highly recommended from me. So I recommend that you watch it. But okay, let's talk about the rest of it. So yes, the Mary Tilford spreads this lie. And it's the scene where she tells her grandmother is very interesting because they're in the back of this car and she's kind of going, it's very like, you know, a young girl telling gossip, like, well, so-and-so said this and so-and-so said this. And the grandmother has to kind of put it together from these little bits and pieces. And yeah, so it's played really interestingly. And there's a few moments where, and again, it's like, it's not really said explicitly. Later in the film, there's an explicit sentence of like, they said that we are lovers. And like, that's as, I think explicit as anything has ever said. But there's several moments where you know that the information is being told, but it's in the distance and it's silent and we can't hear it. But I thought that was a really nice touch. The one in there in the car, they're like, it shows the driver is driving them. He has the glass window up so we can't hear, but we see the grandmother's reaction to hearing this secret. And then later when, so all the girls are being pulled out of school because the gossip is spread around between all the moms in town. And they're like, why is everyone pulling their kids out of school? What's going on? We're going to go bankrupt. And one of the dads finally tells one of them the rumor. But again, it's off in the distance. And we just see Audrey Hepburn's body language as she's hearing this and then telling Shirley MacLaine too. And it's just really well done. So I am a fan of the direction that William Wyler put together with this. But yes, so from there... I don't know. Do you want to take a crack at some of the plot? I feel like I'm talking too much.
Oh, no, it's fine. You chose a good period because there was like sirens going off in the background, you know, reminding everyone I live in a city.
Yes.
From there, things get very dark. There's a suit brought against the girls. Which, you know, could totally, you know, end the school as we know it. But even the suit itself doesn't even really matter at that point, because just having this rumor in existence, you know, ruins their school. Eventually, the James Garner, Audrey Hepburn thing develops further, and, you know, she confronts him and asks him whether or not he believed the rumor to be true. And he hesitates, and that hesitation causes her to dump him.
Yeah.
And then she talks to Shirley MacLaine about this, and Shirley MacLaine feels very responsible for the bad things that are happening in Audrey Hepburn's life, because Shirley MacLaine begins to realize that she is in fact in love with Audrey Hepburn, or Martha realizes she's in love with Karen. Yeah. And even after the grandmother learns the truth. Tries to backpedal, tries to give them money with a settlement. Karen, I should say, refuses. Mm-hmm. And even though things look like maybe they'll get better then, you know, Martha feels so overwhelmed with guilt that she hangs herself. And the movie ends at her funeral with everything kind of sad.
I did not expect that ending, like even knowing, you know. And so I think it is a good one in a way. It's not a happy movie to talk about for Pride Month, but I think it is, like, that's still a problem, you know. That's a very real problem. And I think the scene where it's where Shirley MacLaine is, you know, confessing that I do have these feelings, and she has so much internalized shame about it, clearly. And so I just think it's like we feel all the shame from her. And so I thought, you know, if this was real life, this might happen. And I didn't think that would happen in this movie, but it does, that she dies by suicide. But,
very dark, very, very, very dark. But I mean, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, like, you know, in 1961, we're not going to get a big, you know, pride movie or, like, you know, legalized gay, anything like that is not going to happen. But I think in a way this movie probably did something to kind of foster empathy, because we see alongside Shirley MacLaine, like, the movie is on her side, you know, in a way, and she's not like a villain. Yeah. And so I can imagine for people at the time and people today watching this can see like, one, this isn't a choice. Like this is, and it's not something that basically that the problem is society and their treatment of her with this and like how much damage it does to her to, to have, you know, all the talk of it's a sin and all this, that's like in the legal system, and all of that. And that ultimately leads to her where she ends up. And it's just really heavy. And like, yeah, I it's a serious movie and it's a dramatic movie, but until that ending, it didn't, I didn't realize it had quite the teeth that it has, I think. And it really, really impacted me. So yes, I think this movie, in a way shines a light on an issue that's still very much a real issue.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so important. It's such a great example of how, homosexuality was dealt with during this period. You know, if we went back, to the early 30s and the, into the 30s, less so as the code comes into play, the production code, but, you know, there are depictions of gay people, in as like very coded, flamboyant, you know, characters that are kind of, you know, just there for laughs. And that's kind of the first representation you really get. Then once they actually start tackling the subject, as the restrictions loosen in the 60s, you get movies like this. And even after the code breaks down, the shame is what is largely explored. And you'll have other movies that tackle this a few years later. Midnight Cowboy is a very famous example of something very, very violent and dark happening, which could be read as a response to internalized homophobia. And especially since that movie was directed by a gay man, which takes it even farther. This is one of the earliest examples of what is going to become a trope, which is a double-edged sword because it does, on the one hand, actually show in an empathetic way something that was not being discussed and was considered illegal in much of the country. But at the same time, it also is perpetuating this suicide aspect, which is very real and very honest. But for a long time, that was it as far as homosexual depictions on film. So you can only imagine what it would be like to only see death as your choice in cinema. So I picked it because I think it I think it's a great movie, but I also think it is a very, perhaps the best example of a very unfortunate trend that becomes becomes a very just a very interesting trend that happens over the next couple of decades after this movie.
Yeah, I guess it's a while before there's really movies celebrating, you know, gay joy and that kind of thing.
To be fair, I mean, like outside of some smaller examples, you know, there's a few indie films that are smaller movies, you know, probably the most famous early example would be like Boys in the Band. Which was remade this last year. You know, and there's some other not super well known, but I mean, then, you know, in the 80s, particularly in the 90s, when they really start making movies about it, you know, AIDS becomes the, the overwhelming topic. I don't think positive queer representations really happened until the 21st century in any type of regular way. You know, in the 90s, we started getting more like, you know, the sympathetic gay best friend and my best friend's wedding, or or In and Out, you got a good, more positive representation. But even then, a lot of the positive representations, you know, in the post-Ellen, post-Will and Grace world have not been of lesbians or trans people. They've been of white gay men, which is, it's interesting that that's the, and they've been played by straight men, largely.
That's a whole other interesting conversation about, you know, should that be the case? But anyway, go on.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, even when Will and Grace was on the air, Sean Hayes was not out until after Will and Grace, the original series ended. So, you know, and Eric McCormick is straight, and there's nothing, he's, I wouldn't change the cast of that show. Yeah. I'm just saying it is interesting, that, you know, the first, it seems like such progress, but it should be noted that the progress for, you know, speaking specifically to this movie, lesbian representation on film outside of perhaps being used as a sexualization by straight men, does, is something that I still think is, struggling to happen, because, you know, we've had movies like Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and we've had Carol, but as far as, you know, a happy lesbian movie, have we really gotten a lot of happy lesbian movies?
Not really. I'm recommending, the only thing I could think of is whatever that Christmas movie was last year with Kristen Stewart in it.
I know. And that wasn't that was, you know, a Netflix movie. That wasn't a huge major release. But so there, I think that this is another movie. This is an important movie to talk about as well, because, like, how far have we really progressed from this moment?
Yeah, wow, that's a really good point. And
yeah
well, that is very
interesting. Bring everything down.
That's okay. Well, I was gonna ask, do you know anything about the response to this movie at the time?
Well, looking at the box office, it had a pretty large budget for the time. 3.6 million is the figure I'm seeing. And it only made 3 million at the box office, which would have been a respectable amount to make in the early 60s, but not if your production costs are that high. You know, you always want to make double the production cost. I am assuming that this was probably, when movies are depressing like this, you know, I don't know if it has much to do with material as it did with the fact that people just didn't want to see an unhappy movie with, with Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine. But the movie has kind of grown, I think, in respect because of its unique place that it plays in history, and the fact that it was featured in this wonderful 90s documentary called The Celluloid Closet that I mentioned earlier. I think that brought new awareness to it for the queer community. And the fact that it is in the canon of two of the more popular actresses of all time probably helps, helps it in stature a little bit, but it was not a huge, hit at the time. I don't know if a box office bomb is the right word, because it did get nominated for 5 Academy Awards, and including Best Supporting Actress for Faye Bainter, who played the grandmother, cinematography, costume design, art direction, sound. I will say the art direction and the cinematography for the moment in which Audrey Hepburn discovers Shirley MacLaine, it's pretty haunting.
Yeah.
They do a great job of that moment.
There are several really good shots that there's like two shots of them standing together, or there's one where the little girl, Mary, they're trying to get the truth out of her, and she has both of the women over her shoulders, and it's just this kind of close up on her. Yeah. The camera work is really, really well done. I did note that.
Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
Well, anything else we need to talk about with this movie?
I mean, probably could come up with a million things, but you know, I suppose you do other stuff on this podcast too.
So. I suppose so. Well, that is The Children's Hour. We do recommend it. Really interesting, especially like as a cultural document of that time. And I'm so glad that I've seen it and that we talked about it. Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the top of the show some resources as far as the Trevor Project is doing studies about, you know, suicide among LGBTQ youth. And I think that's really important work. So I'll link to some things there. Because I think, you know, educating yourself about the reality that's still going on that kind of along mm-hmm. these lines is an important thing. And it's an important step towards, you know, systemic change. So check that out. I recommend reading through that. Yeah. So that is, oh, and I did want to ask you one more thing, Rance. What did Shirley MacLaine say at the TCM festival? Oh, that was incorrect.
I forgot. I forgot. She told the ending of the movie and she was describing something about the way the scene was shot, but she remembered it to where Audrey Hepburn committed suicide and not her. And she was describing her discovering Audrey's body. And that was not the way the movie ended. So I don't know where her brain was. I don't know if she was saying the wrong name or she just totally remembered the plot differently, but
that's so interesting. I always wonder, like with actors, especially who've been acting for so long, like, do you remember everything about every movie you've ever done? Probably not.
Probably not.
Well, that is really cool. I wonder if that, cause some of those TCM things are on YouTube and stuff. I'll try and find that and put in the show notes if it's out there. Cause that sounds like an interesting Q&A.
Maybe on YouTube. I don't know if TCM officially recorded it, but maybe somebody uploaded it illegally. Oh. I'm sure they did. I think they recorded everything, but you know, whether or not it's out there,
yeah.
Who knows? Anyway.
Well, that is The Children's Hour. Thank you so much, Rance, for joining me for this. I'm so excited. So next time on for our other Pride Month episode, we're going to do, the plan is to talk to a trans woman named Evelyn Landau, who is a filmmaker, and we're going to talk about a Netflix documentary called Disclosure, which is about sort of the history of trans representation in the media, specifically in movies and TV. And so I'm glad, Rance, that you and I talked about sort of, you really just brought in a lot of good kind of context for representation since then and a little bit before then and all of that, because Disclosure does that for trans people, and it's really, I've watched it once before. I'm going to rewatch in the next couple weeks, but I'm excited to look at that one, and it is it kind of shows the good, the bad, and the ugly, because there have been some good things, especially in recent years, and it interviews a lot of trans actors and filmmakers. And it's really, really fascinating. So check that out. That's on Netflix, easy to watch, Disclosure, and tune in for that for next time. But till then, thanks so much, Rance, and I guess we'll talk to you. In a few weeks, we'll get back to our Technicolor marathon and talk about the red shoes. But till then, I guess we'll say,
I can't wait.
Farewell till then. Thanks, Rance.
Farewell.
And with that, thank you for listening to Art House Garage. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Art House Garage, leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Art House Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Art House Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter by going to arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Art House Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob-free.